My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Hello, this is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Jacqueline Rowell, standing in for Coral Lee. This episode is part of a special series in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Our new issue, 21.1, features articles on food and power, on care work, and on chefs, restaurants, and culinary creativity. As well, Gastronomica continues to publish its COVID dispatches, short portraits of responses to the food crises of this pandemic. For 6 weeks, join hosts from the Gastronomica Editorial Collective as we talk with authors. My guest this week is Professor Alicia Galvez to discuss her forthcoming piece, Paqueteros and Paqueteras, Humanizing a Dehumanized Food System. Alicia Galvez is a cultural and medical anthropologist and is professor of Latin American and Latino studies at Lehman College and of anthropology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She has published 3 books, including most recently, Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico from the University of California Press in 2018. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the show, Alicia.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So to begin, maybe just if you could give us a little bit of a background and overview of the project. Can you briefly tell listeners what you do and where you're based?
Sure. I teach anthropology, Latin American and Latino studies. And my research really sits at the intersection of health, food, and migration. That's sort of the through line between my different projects, which might seem a little bit unrelated from the outside. And I live in Manhattan, but I teach and do most of my research in the Bronx, as well as in Mexican communities that are based in the states of Puebla, Oaxaca, and some other parts of Mexico.
Great. And now you've published 3 books, the most recent being Eating NAFTA, Trade and Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico. And that focuses on the ways in which policies transformed food systems and forms of sustenance in Mexico. So the piece that we're going to discuss today examines the highly personalized and formal courier networks that move food between family members across international borders. So what key questions or currents connected your research over time? And you'd mentioned health, food, and migration. But specifically, how did that motivate your interest in this particular topic of informal food couriers?
Well, it's interesting because I hadn't really been formally researching paqueteros, but they had been such a huge part of the communities that I was connected to through my research. And I just saw the core role that they were playing, the ways that they connect people who are divided by borders, the way that their mobility enables people who don't have the same mobility to connect, both in terms of material goods, right, because the paqueteros transport material goods, but really to connect more symbolically in care networks with family members and friends of people who have migrated and their communities of origin. And I became really interested in just kind of drawing out some of the things that I had learned about paqueteros over 20 plus years of research to really emphasize the ways that they are providing an antidote and a counterexample in this era of globalization. While so much of globalization is about mobility, it's also about homogeneity and about more of us having access to the same things in more places. And paqueteros are really about specificity. They're about, you know, transporting someone's grandmother's mole or someone's grandmother's dried herbs or healing balms or spices. from one place to another. And so there's a level of specificity and care that's enabled that helps, in fact, to ameliorate some of the traumatic and painful aspects of the mobility that's been produced by migration and precisely by those sort of trade policies and agricultural policies that have displaced so many people from their communities of origin in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And so can you tell us a little bit more about Paqueteros and Paqueteras? What does it mean? Could you offer a sense of the range and scope and history?
Sure.
And maybe also a little bit about the gender dynamics?
Sure. So a paquete is a package. It's a package. And so paqueteros are dealers in packages, essentially, literally is the translation. And what they do is they transport goods from one place to another. They aren't necessarily transnational, but my article focuses on the ones that operate between Mexico and the New York area. And because most of the people who reside in the New York area who are from Mexico come from a region called the Mixteca, which is Puebla and Oaxaca and Guerrero states. That's the sort of geographic domain that I was most interested in. And what they do is they informally transport goods. They might do it in overland. Sometimes they'll carry vehicles, electronic goods. Oftentimes the things going north to south are consumer goods and electronics, computers, vehicles, stereo equipment, etc. And the things going south to north are often food, food ingredients, souvenirs, artisanal handcrafts go from south to north. And so paqueteros will fly and transport goods in suitcases, or they might transport goods overland. And the thing that really sets them apart from their customers is that they have mobility. And unfortunately, because of current migration policies, the majority of people who were born in Mexico who reside in the New York area currently don't have access to regularize their immigration status and therefore don't have mobility. So to have mobility is a kind of unique advantage that the paqueteros have that kind of sets them apart. But otherwise, they're very similar to their customers in that they're from the same communities that they serve. And they often know, you know, it's their neighbors and friends and family members who they're transporting goods for. So it's a very humanizing system. And paqueteros and paqueteras, you know, can be anyone really. There, you know, I know of a 65-year-old grandmother who does it, a 45-year-old father. The 45-year-old father lost his visa, and so his 20-year-old daughter has started to do it. She's the one that drives the truck overland over 3 days from the state of Puebla all the way to New York City and back. So it's a pretty badass profession. It requires a lot of knowledge and a lot of courage to navigate a lot of different legal contexts and points of risk. But it's a pretty amazing practice as well, because it enables people to really stay connected to their communities and to their families.
Thank you. And you raise so much there. And I have a lot of questions, you know, about informality, about risk, about community connections. So I'd like to move forward to some of those questions. But first, if you could tell us a little bit about your methods. So in the course of writing this piece, what kinds of materials did you look at? And what were some of the challenges of your research? And how did you overcome them?
Well, I hadn't, as I mentioned, I hadn't really formally sought out to study paqueteros. So I didn't really come up with, you know, a formal research study to do this. What I realized was that over the course of having done my three prior major research projects that resulted in books, I had gathered a lot of information about paqueteros along the way and had done interviews with them. And in fact, the family that I stay with when I do research in the part of Puebla that I go to most often is a family of paqueteros. And so a lot of what I've been able to observe over the years, I observed because of those connections and information that I gathered while researching other questions. And this particular article emerged because, and it's a story, you know, maybe I'll tell in a few minutes, but I was contacted by federal attorneys who wanted me to testify in a federal criminal case as an expert witness about Paquetería. And I asked them why they chose me, and they said there hadn't been any publications about Paquetería. There was nothing that really kind of explained this practice or contextualized it culturally or historically. And the brief mentions in my prior work led them to ask me to be an expert witness. So it led me to realize that there was really a need to publish some of this information, because unfortunately paqueteros are maligned and are discriminated against, and they're profiled and criminalized in ways that are very unjust and unmerited, and in fact quite violent and damaging to them and their communities. And so I thought it was an important role that I played to gather, you know, the notes, the field notes that I had. I'm an ethnographer, so I, you know, work one-on-one with families, with individuals over an extended period of time. And so I, you know, combed through, you know, 20 years of field notes and observations and photographs, and was able to gather you know, the information that became this article. And then I went back to the paqueteros that I know and asked them to fact check, you know, everything that I had gathered to make sure that I was getting it right. And they were kind enough to do that as well.
And so, you know, if we can talk a little bit more about some of the systemic barriers to this kind of work, is their work part of the informal sector? And if so, what does informality mean in this particular context? And then how are the paqueteros viewed by customs officials, borders agents, airline officials when they're importing packages of food, which are often homemade? How do paqueteros navigate those spaces and interactions?
So there's a really interesting situation that the paqueteros face that is, on the one hand, they're under hyper scrutiny and surveillance. And so literally every single package that they bring through, you know, the airport, is inspected. Whereas a very small percentage, you know, if we think about container ships, and, you know, the trucking system in the United States, a very small percentage of the goods that cross our borders through those sort of massive commercial entry points are inspected. But paqueteros, because they're traveling, you know, with suitcases through JFK, literally every suitcase that they bring in is x-rayed and often tagged for secondary inspection, which means they get pulled out of the regular line that most of us go through as, you know, tourists or work travelers through JFK. They get taken to another room, and then, you know, every piece of luggage is x-rayed again. And often customs officials will pull on rubber gloves, open up the packages, take out every item, and inspect it by hand. So paqueteros typically, you know, it's both formal and informal. It's informal in the sense that they are not licensed as importer-exporters. They're not doing this in a wholesale fashion. They are individually being contacted by their customers in most cases. There are some, you know, slightly more formal courier services that are on a larger scale that I don't address in the article. But the paqueteros that I'm working with are very small scale. So their customers bring the goods to their house or their business, get them weighed, $5 a pound for whatever they're sending, and it gets packaged in a suitcase that travels under the paquetero's name. So the paquetero is, you know, traveling with these goods and has to assert, like all of us assert, that these are goods that they are transporting, you know, that they're personally aware of what's in their package, is that this is not some kind of commercial enterprise, even though it kind of is. But they're, you know, just the same way when a friend asks me to carry, you know, a packet of cookies to their grandmother, they're carrying goods for people that they know. And so they have to be fully aware of everything that's in their suitcases. They have to know the ins and outs. They have to know that it's okay to carry mole, but if there's chicken in the mole, then that's illegal. They have to know that it's okay to carry dried herbs, but they can't carry aloe vera because it's considered a gel. So they are very versant in, you know, all of the latest rules and regulations as far as what can be allowed in under customs regulations. However, because they are, you know, so informal and so small scale, and they're traveling, you know, often with suitcases that are filled to the brim, there's a nexus of classism, racism, and a very specific kind of idea in the United States of, you know, that really exploded in the Trump era of specifically criminalizing Mexican nationals that tends to presume that what they're doing is somehow illicit, somehow not above board, somehow suspicious. And so they're really treated as being suspect by customs officials who treat their items and their suitcases with disdain, sometimes with disgust, who look down their noses at, you know, the suitcases that are bulging at the seams. And even though the paqueteros are typically traveling more times in a week than your average banker or, you know, high-flying white-collar, you know, international business person, the paqueteros are often treated as though they are unaware or incapable of, you know, kind of efficiently or effectively navigating international travel. So I really wanted to shed light on the irony of this, the absurdity, and also the violence that this does to people who are exercising their rights of mobility and really connecting their communities, engaging in a practice that's really wholesome and connects back, you know, to, you know, we can think back every time, you know, one of us has carried, you know, a grandmother's beloved, you know, bread in our suitcase, or, you know, a friend who travels back from Italy with his favorite cheese from his home community in his suitcase. Every time, you know, any of us is doing that, we're doing the same thing as paqueteros are doing. But they're not viewed with that sort of lens of wholesome nostalgia. They're somehow being framed as kind of being suspect. And that's, to me, you know, wrong, both morally and factually.
Thank you, Alicia. And are there differences at different places in terms of their encounters, their typical encounters with border officials versus in the U.S. and perhaps returning to Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Some things are similar in the sense that they tend to be, you know, coming from working class families, from migrant families that didn't, you know, migrate with all of the, you know, social capital and passports that some of their more elite compatriots did. And so because, you know, they're serving undocumented communities and they're connected to undocumented communities, they are treated sometimes in both countries as kind of being less than, you know, full citizens. So when they go back to Mexico, you know, they will sometimes be greeted very kindly. I've observed, you know, a very polite reception on many occasions by Mexican airport personnel, airline personnel, customs officials who say, you know, welcome home, compatriot, bienvenido, paisano. While I've also observed them being mistreated by airline personnel and kind of, you know, their luggage being treated disdainfully because it's not, you know, matching Louis Vuitton luggage or whatever. And sometimes they're traveling in first class because, again, they're frequent flyers. They accumulate more points than most of us ever dream of. And so, you know, they aren't treated with the respect that their mobility merits. They're treated sometimes in a classist and racist way that has to do with, you know, their class status and their racialization, sometimes as being from indigenous communities or working class communities. And then we also see, you know, there can be manipulation where they're asked to pay, you know, legitimate or illegitimate fees, you know, when they're transporting goods across the border. Most paqueteros tend to say that U.S. officials are less likely to ask for bribes and more likely to behave in a, you know, transparent fashion. But that's not, you know, 100% the case always. But they tend to fear having to pay bribes more often on the Mexican side. But the discrimination happens on both sides. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. And this is something that you also address in the article itself. So this piece will be forthcoming in issue 21.1 in Gastronomica, which will be online within the next week or so. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in just a moment to talk more with Alicia Galvez.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. My name is Samantha Garner, and I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm a Cheeselandian because I take cheese seriously, just like they do in Wisconsin. Cheeselandia is a community for loud and proud cheese lovers brought to life by Wisconsin Cheese. I know that I can always cook amazing food with their cheese, and it's even good enough just to snack on. As a Cheeselandia member, I know there is always a supportive community behind me who always gets as excited as I do about cheese. Go to cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up. Check us out on Instagram at Cheeselandia.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten with Jacqueline Rowell talking with Alicia Galvez about her article Paqueteros and Paqueteras, Humanizing a Dehumanized Food System, available in the forthcoming issue of Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about the role of paqueteros in the markets. You write, quote, paqueteros operate in the gaps and omissions of the increasingly global and industrial transnational food system, satisfying a demand for very particular food products that is not meant by the market, end quote. So on average, how much does it cost to procure a package and who typically pays for it? Would that be the sender, the recipient? Can you walk us through in a little bit more detail what that transaction looks like from beginning to end? What are some of the most popular culinary items? As I think connected to that, you know, what makes these food items valuable in the eyes of their consumers? Is it a question of place of origin, of flavor quality, of family connection? You know, how is that all wrapped up in the actual transaction?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So paqueteros might be contracted by the person they might be paid by the person sending or the person receiving. Typically, people in the United States, residing in the United States, tend to have more access to cash. Part of the reason that people have migrated is because the wage differential can be, you know, around 10 times the wages in the United in Mexico on an hourly basis. And so typically the family members, the customers who reside in the US tend to have more purchasing power. But what they can't purchase, you know, if you're residing in the United States, are some of the very specific local products that might be from a community of origin. So to give just one example, I think a lot of us in the United States are familiar with chiles poblanos. If you've ever had a chile relleno or, you know, any kind of stuffed chile like chiles en nogadas, it will typically be the large green chile poblano. Chile poblano is pretty accessible in the United States now. You're not going to see it in every supermarket, but it's not impossible to get. But if you go to Puebla, chile poblano mean is the adjective for something that's from Puebla. It turns out that there's thousands of varieties of chiles that look, you know, to an untrained eye like chiles poblanos. So there's chiles de Miahuatlán, which are spicier, slightly smaller, slightly thinner skinned than chile poblano. So if you're from Miahuatlán, the average chile poblano that you can get in a supermarket in New York City or New Jersey is not going to satisfy the, you know, the flavor profile, the specific culinary needs that you have if you really wanted a chile de Miahuatlán. this is going to happen over and over again. Mole poblano, mole is a term that can be used to refer to any kind of ground, any salsa that is, you know, with ground products. So chile, mole poblano is made with chiles, with a little bit of cacao, with nuts and dried fruits and a lot of different spices. It can have 100 ingredients. Even though mole poblano is pretty widely available these days in New York City, every rural community, and in fact, every household, has its own particular take on mole poblano. So for someone who has migrated, who's first generation, you know, any old mole is not going to, you know, be as satisfying, as gratifying, especially for special occasions, as the mole that is made in your home community. And so it's worth it to ask the paquetero to bring it to you. If you can do that, if you have someone who can supply you with that from your home community, then to try to secure it or replicate it here in the United States. So it's that particular nostalgia economy of very particular foodstuffs. And I, one of the things that I argue in the article is that this is kind of a perfect storm in which paqueteros really need, you know, a certain number of migrants in order to have a viable customer base. If a community is super recently arrived and very, very small, it's not going to sustain, you know, paqueteria businesses. There might be one person who kind of occasionally carries an extra suitcase, but it's not going to really allow for a paquetero to you know, kind of subsist on paqueteria. Likewise, as time goes on and the community ages and the first generation is replaced by the 1.5 and the second generation, I don't see the children of the immigrants that I know, you know, having the same desire or kind of need for that very specific food ingredient that comes from their parents' community of origin. It's really hard to transmit that sort of taste and flavor experience that comes from having grown up eating a particular thing at a particular person's table, migrating, and then, you know, having children and expecting those children to have that exact same food nostalgia. The children will have a food nostalgia for the things they grew up with in whatever place they're growing up. If it's New York City, they might have a craving. And I know, you know, children of Mexican immigrants who have cravings for chopped cheese and particular kinds of New York City pizza slices. And so they're not necessarily going to be the customer base in the future for paqueteros. So paqueteros really fill a very particular temporal as well as geographic niche in terms of serving that first generation of migrants who can't go back and forth perhaps as frequently as they would like or at all, and have that desire for foods from their home community that they can't meet, you know, with the corporate and even the small scale, you know, kind of food purveyors in the places that they've migrated to. And so paqueteros really fill that gap.
Thank you. And, you know, you've mentioned that it really fills a niche market. So is it expensive to procure goods through these means? And if somebody is receiving goods, who typically is a sender? Is it, you know, a family member, a community member, a small business? Can it be all of the above? What does that transaction look like?
It could be all of the above, but typically it's family members. And it can go either direction. So I know, you know, people who have said, you know, they'll be sitting around, you know, a kitchen table in a Bronx apartment and say, you know what, it would be really nice, you know, for so-and-so's birthday, if we could make some, you know, mole, some chicken and or turkey and mole for them. Why don't we get, you know, our grandmother or our aunt to send the mole? And so they will, you know, commission essentially, you know, a shipment through a paquetero. And it's not expensive. It's $5 a pound for goods. So, you know, let's say the aunt has a mole business. The aunt may not send the mole for free, right? So she'll charge for the mole and then she'll charge for the shipping, which would be $5 per pound for the goods. And it can also go the other direction. So when my friend Maria Pacheco, who's mentioned in the article, it's a pseudonym that I use for her, when she gave birth, she experienced a lot of postpartum difficulties. And her mother said, you know what, you really need to, you know, use these herbs in order to recover more quickly from childbirth. These herbs will help you to heal more quickly. I'm going to send them with the paquetero. And so the mother, you know, the way that she provided care from afar was to procure the herbs, some of which she grew in her own garden and some of which she needed to get from other places, but they were easy to get in her community and not possible to get in the Bronx. And so she sent them with a paquetero to Maria, whose husband, you know, would not typically be the person in their rural community. The husband would not typically be in charge of preparing the herbal remedies. But he got on the phone with his mother-in-law, and his mother-in-law walked him through the steps to prepare the tinctures and the steam, you know, the herbs that would be used in a steam bath, as well as teas, for her to recover. And so they engaged in, you know, a practice, a collective practice, collaborative project, where he did something that was a little bit outside of the ordinary in terms of his role and his knowledge set. He didn't know what to do with the herbs without his mother-in-law explaining it. And his mother-in-law typically would do it, but she wasn't physically there, right? So they were able to overcome those barriers through paquetería and through the phone in order for Maria to feel, you know, cared for, which was the first step to her postpartum healing.
And that's a really lovely example of how the paqueteros facilitate meaningful connections and connect people and communities across mm-hmm. borders to humanize the increasingly dehumanized food system, which is the primary argument of your article. So on the one hand, we can talk about paqueteros as a small business, as a source of livelihood, and as a micro enterprise that meets a demand unfulfilled by the market. And mm-hmm. then on the other hand, paqueteria serve communities. And, you know, food provisioning in this case, the delivery of care packages is really a kind of care work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now we are rounding up on 31 minutes. I just have a couple of questions, you know, looking forward, looking ahead as we wrap up. So your work here is largely ethnographic, but could it have implications for policy? How might this research inform policymaking? Or are there any specific policy changes that you'd like to see that's emerged from this work?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a couple of different angles, there are policy changes I would like to see. One is, I think that we have unfortunately created a situation through our global and our domestic food and trade policies. We've created a situation where large corporations are favored. You know, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, makes it very easy for huge corporations to produce produce and ship it across the border as though there were no border, right? It really eliminates the barriers of mobility for corporate goods and capital. But one, of course, glaring omission in that arrangement is that people don't have the same mobility. And the, you know, things that are made by small scale producers don't have that mobility. And so we've come to understand globalization to mean homogenization, which some people have kind of, you know, simplistically and effectively kind of framed as, you know, kind of the McDonald'sization or the Walmartization of the global food system, where we kind of all have access to, you know, corporate snack foods and soda and fast foods. But it becomes much more difficult and expensive and even luxurious to eat locally, to eat in culturally specific ways, and to connect across borders if you aren't a banana or, you know, a tomato or a processed food package. And so I think that, you know, policy needs to really take into consideration small scale production and the ways that it's sustaining of health. It's a lot healthier to eat food that has been produced on a small scale, that's not full of chemicals, to cut out the middlemen in a lot of the steps between growers and consumers, to enable greater mobility of the people who engage in the food production work, to value local communities and the flavors and foods and culinary knowledge, and in many cases, indigenous knowledge of centuries and millennia that have gone into ways of eating and ways of sustaining and protecting health and communities that are really being ravaged by our current policy landscape. And, you know, even though, thank goodness, we don't have anyone in the White House who's currently trying at the moment to, you know, vilify and criminalize Mexico as a country and Mexicans as people, and to shut the border and build a wall, I don't yet see the level of creativity I would like to see in the new administration to really humanize our food system and to kind of give less, you know, power, take away some of the power of corporations to determine how we eat, what we eat, and who is doing the production of food. And I think to really kind of empower people like paqueteros, and we can think even of, you know, in New York City, you know, the food vendors, you know, the small scale food producers who during this pandemic are the ones that, you know, really showed us the way through when the corporate food system faltered and failed in many places to feed us. I think this is, you know, something that we need to learn from moving forward in the future.
Thank you, Alicia. And just a note on the to pick up on your note on the vendors in New York City, just this past week, Intro 1116B passed in City Council. So we saw legislative reform for the first time in decades to lift the cap on vending permits. Now that, you know, this kind of connects to my final question for you, you know, the pressures that we're seeing over the last year for small scale producers, small, medium sized enterprises, under the conditions of the pandemic. Have you continued to follow the story of the paqueteros and paqueteras? After, you know, you've obviously completed the research and writing of this paper before the pandemic, but how might the pandemic have affected paqueteria? On the one hand, we've seen a surge in the food courier business, often platform and technology driven. And then on the other hand, substantial restrictions on mobility, particularly across international borders. So could you comment on that, what you've seen over the last year? Any pivots?
Yeah. I mean, it's been, the pandemic has been devastating, you know, no less devastating for paqueteros and the communities that they serve. I think one of the biggest problems has been that undocumented immigrant communities have just been ravaged by the pandemic's economic effects, in addition to being, you know, kind of hyper exposed and at risk of infection. Where I work in the Bronx has the highest rates in New York City of COVID deaths and infections, and so, as well as the highest rates of job loss. And so people have been on it, you know, to get your grandmother's mole is, you know, a luxury beyond reach. And, you know, the paqueteria is in good times a kind of remittance in which people are, you know, sending money and getting goods. And so it helps to enable some people to not migrate in their home communities because they're receiving, you know, resources and, you know, consumer goods and other things that they receive from their migrant family members in the U.S. And so remittances are really down. People are struggling. A lot of families I know, you know, have gone from multiple working adults in the household to maybe one working adult in the household. And that one working adult has gone from working five or six days a week to working 2 days a week, maybe even fewer hours than a full day on those 2 days. And so they're really struggling to survive. And so they've been unable to engage the services of paqueteria. That being said, I have heard of some paqueteria services being used just in terms of herbs and healing remedies. People who are closed out of the formal healthcare system, and people who practice all kinds of non-Western healing practices, you know, need herbs and other kinds of goods in order to do that. And some of those aren't available. So I have heard of paqueteros, you know, transporting some of that stuff still to the degree that they can. But for the most part, the border has been, you know, pretty difficult to cross. There was a little bit of an opening for a while. I think right now it's open. And, you know, sometimes if they travel over land, you know, they can, you know, sometimes creatively navigate the quarantine rules if you're coming overland as opposed to through an airport. It sometimes alters what the quarantine rules are upon arrival. And Mexico has incredibly high rates of COVID as well. I think Mexico is number three right now, and US is first, and I believe Brazil is second. So people in their home communities have been very, you know, vulnerable to the disease. So it's a tough time all around. But I'm hoping that between the new administration, hopefully things getting better with the vaccination, eventually becoming more available, people will hopefully be able to regularize a little bit their status. And the ideal would be, you know, Biden is talking about a plan to regularize the status of the 11 million people who have had no pathway to legalization since 1986. So that would be a whole generation. That would be basically the entire customer base of the paqueteros that I work with. What their family members would, you know, and customers would suddenly have mobility. And that could be really incredible. I think we could see a cultural flourishing of, you know, people reconnecting to their communities of origin, you know, celebrating their cuisine, artisans, you know, small businesses. I mean, it could just have an incredibly positive impact in addition to the basic and most elemental positive impact, which would be to allow families to reunite who've been separated for decades by the border.
Absolutely. Alicia, thank you for joining us today. We're going to wrap up now. I still have many more questions, but I will direct listeners to read the full article in Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, which is available in volume 21.1 in February 2021. For more details, visit gastronomica.org. Join us next week as editorial collective Krishnendu Ray hosts an episode on the forthcoming piece, Rumor in Chinese Diets and COVID-19, Questions and Answers about Chinese Food and Eating Habits. Thanks very much, Alicia, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.